Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Across the Dinerverse, searching for the heart and soul of America, one diner at a time. How you doing? I'm John Murphy, writer and producer on the CBS Science and Technology series, Innovation Nation. And now I drive and fly around the country talking to people I meet in diners and restaurants about their lives, their profession, and how they feel we're doing as a nation. You know, we're kind of all in this together, not just in America, but on the planet, and hopefully hearing different people's stories and life journeys, it will help instill a sense of compassion and acceptance for who they are. Just another human being like you and I, doing the best they can on a daily basis. So before we get started, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you very much in advance. It really means a lot. Or become a patron, where for as little as $3, you can ask me questions, send comments about the show, suggest diners I should visit, get behind-the-scenes photos and content, and engage with me one-on-one. Simply visit patreon.com/dinerverse. That's patreon.com/dinerverse. So my wife Dana and I braved the heat for a weekend trip to Las Vegas and kind of wanted to see this new MSG Sphere, which is due to open this September, kicking off U2's residency in Vegas. It seats 18,600 people and is the largest spherical building in the world. But more impressive is the fact that it's a giant LED orb. But check this out, 580,000 square feet of programmable lighting. And that can turn the exterior of the sphere into a Halloween jack-o'-lantern, a fireworks display, and even Earth. Imagine staggering down the strip, drunk out of your mind, and seeing the Earth just sitting right there on the street. That's crazy. And I predict massive fender benders and accidents and lawsuits. Which leads me to this week's episode. We grabbed lunch at a hole-in-the-wall place called Lou's Diner on Decatur Boulevard, and I saw this guy about my age wearing shorts and a t-shirt, and the t-shirt said Trial Lawyers University. Kind of wondering what that was. Never heard of that before. So I went over, introduced myself, and met a guy named Dan Ambrose, a lawyer turned trial consultant. And even though you think you know how lawyers, the law, and the justice system really works, and the thousands of TV shows about it, you would be mistaken. So, Dan, thank you very much for allowing me to talk to you a little bit about this. I noticed your Trial Lawyers University t-shirt. What is Trial Lawyers University?
Well, Trial Lawyers University is a educational platform that I was fortunate enough to start during the pandemic because, as you know, everybody experienced, we were all locked down together, and it gave me the idea.
So are you a trial lawyer?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I got licensed in about 1995. I was really active as a criminal defense lawyer until about 2013. And then I got a little less active. I still try cases, you know, maybe one a year or so. But I moved to California to become a plaintiff's personal injury lawyer. And so I had quite the shift in careers, which requires a major shift in learning, because being a personal injury lawyer is a whole different world than being a criminal defense lawyer.
Do you mind if we go back and just, I want to talk about the criminal defense thing, because where did you practice criminal defense law?
The suburbs and surrounding areas of Detroit, Michigan.
Oh, that's a tough place.
Well, Detroit is a tough place. It's gotten a little less tougher, I think, as it's got more a little, I call it gentrification. So every time I go back there, I'm impressed with the amount of new buildings and new development in downtown. I'm very happy for, you know, the city and my friends that still live there, because when I left, it was not so interesting of a place.
So you would represent people who are charged with what kind of crimes?
Every type of crime, you know, from DUIs to murder. Now, you know, things like murder, rape, child abuse, they're a lot less frequent than a DUI or retail fraud, but almost every kind of case.
How many murder cases did you try?
Just one. One murder case.
Did you win?
Yes.
Well, that's so good.
Thank God. Then it was the craziest thing, because like it was kind of like a pro bono case.
And which means it's Latin for free, right?
Yes. It wasn't quite free. I think he paid me like $1,000, because like, you know, his name was Reginald Burks, and you know, he didn't have any money, and he was in jail. And so if somebody doesn't make money in jail, well, you're not going to get paid a lot. And, you know, the reason why I took the case was because I, you know, truly believe, you know, once I did a little research and understand the story, really believe he was innocent. And
well, what was the case?
Oh, he was accused of shooting this young man, just flat open firing into a car and killing this young man. You know, but what actually happened is that there was this young man in a van with some other folks who were rather, they were criminals. They were driving around and, you know, holding people up and robbing them. And they kind of held up my client's younger brother. And my client was an armed security guard. So when this was happening, he pulled out his gun to, you know, kind of protect his brother. You know, then they opened fire on him and he shot back. And so he thought that the shot that he shot back inadvertently shot this young man in the head. But that's not what happened. He was shot in the head by the person who was driving the car, by his, you know, I guess his adopted mom, because I think this woman adopted these children just to get money.
Wait, the mother of these guys was the driving the getaway car?
Yes. But I don't think it was like a real mother-son relationship from what I could tell, because she wasn't too remorseful and her so-unquote son was dead there and she was the shooter. Because I mean, and you know, I basically proved that during the trial because I hired a blood splatter expert. I still remember his name. I have a terrible memory, but his name was Joe Slemko. And he was a police captain up in Alberta. And so we were basically able to prove the guy's innocence, even though you prove somebody's innocence in the court of law, the prosecutor still doesn't drop the case, even though it's factually impossible. I mean, the jury was out 15 minutes, but still, you know, you lose a lot of sleep over something like this because you're thinking, what am I missing? What am I missing? Why, you know, if I showed him point blank that this guy's innocent, why do they keep pressing?
Because of the way the law works, when you got this information and you got this factual, you know, blood splatter pattern and this, you know, you were able to prove to the prosecutor that your client didn't do it. Did you do this outside of the court to try and get him to drop the charges?
I mean, I showed him the evidence because I had to amend my witness list because I needed to hire this guy, Joe Slemko, the blood splatter expert, to come in. And of course, the prosecutor wouldn't agree, but as one-sided, I thought the judge was, you know, kind of one-sided in the case, you know. And, you know, the truth is a lot of judges are a bit one-sided because they're former prosecutors and, you know, they're elected, so they're all about law and order. But this was really, you know, when the rulings are, judge isn't supposed to decide guilt or innocence, but he's supposed to give a fair trial. And if he's intentionally excluding evidence, preventing, you know, exculpatory evidence from coming in, well, it's a little frustrating because you're fighting two prosecutors and one's got a black robe on. And so it's just really challenging. And especially when it's, you know, you're dipping into your own pocketbook to pay for everything, like experts and stuff. And you're not even, you know, I didn't make much money back then. So it was a little more of a dip than it would be today. Let's put it that way.
But the guy got off.
He did get exonerated. I think getting off would imply that he had done something wrong.
All right. So he was exonerated.
He was exonerated.
Which means found not responsible, not guilty, had nothing to do with it.
Right. His brother, who he was defending in the incident, some 6 months later, actually, you know, was charged with attempted murder. I represent him in that case. Again, pro bono. I don't know what I was thinking at that time. But you know, I truly believe the guy was innocent of what he was being charged with, even though he had a sawed-off shotgun and shot it at people. You know, I mean, but the evidence, the forensic evidence was that he said they shot at him first. And on the street, the police found empty shotgun shells that didn't match the shotgun that my client had. So there had to be another shotgun. Of course, all these little hoodlums denied having a gun. And so, you know, that was a hard-fought battle. It was a nightmare. And, you know, got him acquitted. But then, like, a month later, he went out and murdered somebody in cold blood for a cell phone. And he's still in prison today. So,
wow.
Such is the life of a criminal defense lawyer.
Does that suck the life out of you when you do a trial like that?
Yes. Every trial sucks life out of me. I didn't represent him on the murder trial because, you know, he got his one get-out-of-jail ticket free with me. And, like, from the evidence I saw, he was very guilty. And I got so much energy, and you know, I know everybody deserves a defense, but he does not deserve my defense. And
right.
I wasn't going to go put myself out for another month to try to save somebody who I believe was guilty, because I couldn't save him anyways, because if you don't believe in a client, it's really hard to convince people of something you don't believe in. And I can't say I never have, because sometimes you have to do that as a criminal defense lawyer. If a client doesn't want to take a deal and they tell you that they're innocent, even though the facts may prove show differently, but it's a real tough thing to have to do that. So I haven't had to do that in maybe 20 years, so I try to stay away from those kind of cases.
I'm curious, do you know what percentage of all the lawyers in the world or in America, what percentage are actual, you know, criminal defense trial lawyers that kind of go to battle in court against prosecutors?
Very few. I mean, the reality is most criminal defense lawyers, from my experience, are just not very good because they don't engage in extra training because most of them don't have very much money because it's, you know, it's really hard to make much money being a criminal defense lawyer because the only people, you know, people are hiring you out of their own pocketbook. It's not like some corporation or insurance company's paying you.
But what about like the Johnny Cochran's of the world? I know he's gone and everything, but there's other big attorneys. Who's the big guy? Mark Garagos in L.A.?
Yes.
He makes millions, doesn't he? I thought criminal defense lawyers make millions of dollars.
Well, he does probably make millions of dollars, but I'm pretty sure it's not from doing criminal defense. I mean, pretty sure you get that paid. That
oh, like civil lawsuits?
Correct. Civil lawsuits, mass tort lawsuits. He's into everything. And
that's what you were trying to change to. You were trying to get into personal injury lawsuits.
Correct, as opposed to being a criminal defense lawyer.
Right.
Like to really do personal injury, you know, you have to learn how to litigate. And litigation is a very tedious job of discovery and motions and depositions. And when you get past that, and it's maybe a month out from trial, and you want some help putting your story together, putting your voir dire together, prepping witnesses.
And voir dire is jury selection?
Correct.
Okay.
So if that's what you're interested in, then I'm your guy.
So that's what Trial Lawyers University is. You work with other lawyers to train and prepare them for the long, exhaustive litigation process in a case.
That's one aspect of it. There's, you know, another aspect of it is, you know, we just started a podcast. So, you know, we interview great trial lawyers on who they are and what they believe it takes to become a great trial lawyer and talk about some of their recent cases and what they learned from them.
What makes a great trial lawyer based on your experience and what you've seen?
That's a good question. Because if you ask 10 lawyers, 10 great trial lawyers, you could probably get 10 different answers. My answer would be you have to have some character traits like empathy, tenacity, diligence, patience, and you also have to have a lot of skills. And, you know, the greatest skill of a trial lawyer is really the greatest skill, I mean, to influence, is really the same skill any human being needs to influence, and that's the skill of connecting with people. And that takes a lot of, take a lot of time and practice, especially in the context of a jury trial, because you're trying to connect with a dozen strangers who clearly know that you want something from them. So it's a little more difficult to do that.
Can I share something with you?
Certainly.
I was actually chosen as a juror in LA County on a murder case. And I sat on the jury for 4 weeks, 3 strikes case, gang member. And it was fascinating. You know, most people do their best to get out of jury duty. I got to say, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I was riveted to the proceedings. I was riveted to what the judge was doing. You know, I will be very honest with you. This guy who was the defendant, I humanized him. I saw him, you know, they brought his wife and kid in and he's, you know, a 5-year-old son and he's interacting with the son before court begins and all this. You saw the humanity of this guy. It was a 3 strikes case. So he could be going away for the rest of his life in California. And so I took my job very, very, very seriously, but it's very emotional sitting in that position. I'll just share that with you. It's very emotional, and I listened to every single word. This guy had no way to hire a private criminal defense attorney. It's a public defender, and the prosecutor, Deputy DA, kind of go at it. Fascinating. And we unfortunately had to find him guilty based on the evidence.
Unfortunately, he was a killer, and he had needed to be separated from society.
Here's the facts of the case. Here's what. So you run with the wrong crowd, you're going to get your ass in a sling. So he was one of 3 guys who chased a rival gang member down an alley into a carport. And this rival gang member was pinned in this carport up against a wall. And all 3 of these guys started shooting at him. The ballistics of the bullets from his gun did not match the ballistics of the bullet found inside the deceased. But they still found him guilty because he was part of the 3 and he was still trying to actively kill the guy.
You still find him guilty.
I did.
I know. Well,
based on the instructions given to us by the judge and the facts in the case.
Right, of course. So he shot the guy. He just didn't hit him.
Correct. But he was participating in the attempted murder.
Where were the other 2 shooters?
They ran away and weren't apprehended.
How did this guy get caught?
Well, he's dumb, I guess. And he didn't rat him out.
He's serving.
It's the gang law.
Right. He's serving life with honor.
I guess so. How many cases does a public defender normally take on?
And by I think somewhere between 300 and 400 per year.
In a major city like LA or just anywhere?
Pretty much anywhere. Typically, if it's a bigger city, they just have more public defenders.
Three to 400 cases on a public defender's desk.
Yes.
How many can you possibly go to trial with?
3 or 4.
That's a lot of plea bargaining, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. All right. So back to you, Trial Lawyers University. So you are here to help these guys win.
Correct.
So it's kind of like a great athlete, somebody like a Tom Brady or LeBron James. They have coaches, right? They have trainers. They have PT people. They have fitness people. They have dietitians and chefs. And so you are like one of those specialty coaches for a trial lawyer.
Correct.
Are you any good at it?
Yes.
how am I supposed to know that you're good at it?
Well, without a doubt, trained more trial lawyers in the last 10 years in the physical skills of presentation and connection and story than any other human being walking the face of the earth. But, you know, I work with some of the greatest trial lawyers in the country, you know, like Brian Panish, who's like the king of the West Coast. Most recent case was he represented the family of the woman who was killed by Alec Baldwin.
Oh, wow.
So that was he did the Michael Jackson trial some 10 years ago.
Wow, those are big trials. Did he win?
Well, they settled.
They settled, yeah.
They settled the shooting case, and he did not win the Michael Jackson case. It was the last case that he lost. It was a long time ago. He very rarely loses because he is one of the greatest trial lawyers in America.
And you coach this guy?
A little bit. I mean, I don't, you know, but I go to, you know, been to court with him, helping him with his voir dire and helping with some of his presentations to make him a little bit better.
So let's talk about voir dire. Am I saying that correctly? Voir dire. It's a French word.
Well, it depends where you're at, but some places call it voir dire, some places voir dire.
Voir dire. And that is the process where you are selecting a jury.
Correct.
What is so critical and important about that regarding the criminal defense or for your side? You want to stack the deck?
Of course you want to stack the deck. Who doesn't want to stack the deck in their favor? I mean, allegedly the idea is to find the most fair and impartial and neutral jurors as possible.
That's bullshit.
Well, that's the idea. But it would be great if we could actually do that. You know, in a criminal case, you'd be grateful to find a neutral juror. And in a personal injury case, it'd be great if the jurors start out neutral. But unfortunately, most people start out believing that the prosecution is right. And generally, they are right. I mean, they're probably right 85 to 90% of the time, which is good. But it's the 10 to 15% of the time that they're wrong. But even when they're right, they often overcharge. You know, if somebody is guilty of a simple assault, which would be a 90-day misdemeanor, they charge them with a felonious assault, which is a 5-year felony. Therefore, the person's terrified of going to trial, costs them a ton more money, and then they're going to plead out to something lesser, like a simple assault. And so that way, they do what's called a plea bargain, but it's not really a plea bargain because they overcharged. And that's what a lot of prosecutors' offices typically do.
That's a strategy to stack charges against the defendant so they are convicted of something.
Yes, and that they, you know, that they plead. It's not a matter of getting them convicted at a jury trial. The whole idea is to avoid the jury trial. And, you know, and it's effective because most cases don't go to trial, even criminal cases. There's like maybe 2-4% go to trial.
So if they charge somebody with 5 charges, when they come to the table and agreed to plead guilty to 3 of them, that's a win for the prosecution?
Well, of course. I mean, depending on what the charges are. I mean, if they're charged with 5 counts of open murder, that guy pleads guilty to 3 counts of disturbing the peace. Well, that's not exactly, I mean, and the prosecutor's not, I mean, it really is not supposed to be interested in winning and losing. They're supposed to be interested in obtaining justice. Unfortunately, that's a myth, you know, and that most prosecutors, they want to win at all costs and even at the cost of potentially convicting an innocent person. A lot. I mean, again, it's been a while since I was involved in the criminal justice system. It was really just in one place back in Michigan, and that was my experience then. So hopefully, you know, with things like George Floyd and, you know, all this stuff we see on a daily basis with police officers abusing regular folks, people get more enlightened that, you know what, this is real. This happens all the time. It doesn't matter. You know, obviously people of color, minorities are overly victimized by the police. It's most people in general. Accused of a crime don't have the resources. I believe statistically 90% of people who are accused of a crime use a public defender of some type of another.
One thing I do know is that a prosecutor DA they have the right to use any branch of law enforcement to work their case. They can use the FBI, they can use the local police, they can use the state militia, they can use the IRS, the Treasury Department, Homeland Security, whatever, right?
Well, I think there are jurisdictional limits on state law. You know, if it's a state law prosecutor, I mean, for them to call up the IRS agent and say, hey, you need to go do this for me, it'd be a long stretch. But if it was a federal agency, then they have more control over other federal agencies and state agencies. But the reality is that, you know, if a Los Angeles PD called up the IRS and said, we need to do something, there's probably a pretty good chance it would happen. I don't really know because I haven't had that experience.
But you're saying most people charged with a crime, the odds of them winning are against them.
That's true. I mean, statistically, 97% of the people who are charged, either convicted or found guilty. So,
and when it comes back to the voir dire, the selection of the jury, jury people in the jury pool have a preconceived idea if the person's even charged with the crime, therefore they must be guilty.
I'd say that's true in general. My job is to do my best to, during the voir dire process, to get the jury to be open to the possibility that my client's innocent. And just to give me a chance to prove it.
Yeah.
And even though the prosecutor is supposed to prove him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, I think in a lot of cases you have to show some pretty good evidence of your client's innocence, which is a reasonable doubt, of course, you know, but, you know, I would always set out to try to prove my client's innocence and get as far as I could. But I think the effort in that direction helped win a lot of cases.
When lawyers come out of law school, how good are they? Because they've got all this book learning, you know? The trial cases, the precedent cases, you went through law school, you had to study for the bar exam, but how prepared are they actually to go to a courtroom in front of a judge and a jury and argue a case on behalf of somebody's life who may be in balance?
They're pretty useless. I mean, law school in general is a pretty useless endeavor to prepare somebody to pass the bar exam. And the bar exam, is, especially in California, is extremely difficult. It took me 4 tries to pass it.
Really? 4 times?
4 tries. It's a good thing I'm resilient.
How many times did it take you to pass the bar in Michigan?
1.
Mm.
Of course, I was younger then, just out of law school, more attuned to sitting on my butt and studying for 8-10 weeks in a row. Got a little hard as you get older and get distracted by things, but after I failed, you know, for the 3rd time, I decided to get a tutor, and then I finally passed. Thank God.
If you help an attorney in a personal injury civil case, and they win $10 million for their client, and you worked on this case, do you get a taste of the winnings?
A very small taste. But typically, you know, it depends how you arrange your agreement. You can arrange your agreement that you get a percentage, or you can arrange your agreement, you get a daily rate. And so if I get a daily rate, doesn't matter if they lose the case or get $20 million. My fee's the same.
Right.
If I get a percentage, my fee would be based upon the results. Personally, I always prefer a percentage, but fortunately, most of the cases I work on are very high dollar value cases. Therefore, I usually get, you know, just paid by the day, which I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for.
What is your daily rate? You want to share that?
Well, it's $10,000 a day.
What? 10 grand a day? Wow. I had no idea it was that much. Wow.
Well, I'm fortunate and grateful, but some of my friends that are consultants charge $20,000 a day.
Yeah, geez.
And I'm just thinking, I need more white hair. But it's really just what you charge is what, you know, frankly, whatever you decide the value is worth.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more unique skills you have, the higher you can decide the value. And since I'm the only one in the whole world that really does what I do, I could charge, you know, you could just decide. And if people want to hire you, they hire you. If they don't, they don't. You know, I love doing it, and I love working on different cases, and being part of different stories and verdicts and trials. And I love learning. And every time I get to work, you know, if I get blessed to be invited in a case, I get to learn a ton about the case, about the lawyers, improve my own skills, help them get better, and, you know, emotionally share in the victory, if not. Plus, if, you know, when they win, it's a lot easier to hire.
For sure.
It's a lot easier to hire your consultant next time.
Absolutely.
There's
money.
You know,
exactly.
And, you know, I mean, it's money justice. I mean, the civil law, justice is measured in money.
And the threshold of proof is a lot less, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just more likely than not. So 50.001%. Or if you had two reams of paper next to each other, if you took one ream stack off the top piece of paper and moved it to the other stack, that would satisfy the burden of proof.
Wow.
In a civil case.
Yeah.
So it's just more likely true than not true.
What do you work on with trial lawyers the most? What areas need the most improvement for most trial lawyers?
Well, the area that I'm most effective in can really help them the most in is their ability to connect with the jury. I don't teach trial strategy. I don't teach litigation skills. I just teach the physicality of connection in the context of voir dire or jury selection, opening statement / closing argument, and cross-examination.
Based on all the TV shows I've seen and the movies, I think the opening and closing statements are pretty momentous, aren't they?
They should be. Obviously, things aren't like they are on TV. That goes without saying. I mean, trials take more than 15 minutes to do. And having a great voir dire and a great opening is critical to winning, because obviously you're setting, first of voir dire, you're getting to make sure the jury's open to your theories of the case and hopefully likes you, the lawyer, because they're going to spend days, if not weeks, if not months with you. And if they don't personally like you, well, they're not going to listen to you. And so you have to develop that rapport with the jury, but also you have to make sure that the jury is open to listening to your story.
I'll say, on my experience, I did not like the attitude and the bravado and the brashness of the prosecutor, but I really liked the humanity of the public defender that I watched during my murder case. I thought he was real, spoken in just a common man language, wasn't putting on a show, and I connected with him as a juror more to the public defender than I did the prosecutor. But ultimately, based on the facts, we still had to find the man guilty.
Right. And connection can go a long way.
Yeah.
But sometimes when there's overwhelming evidence against you, the connection really is critical in, I think a civil trial more than it is a criminal trial. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because in a civil trial, for like a personal injury case, you're asking the jury to put a value on something that nobody would ever sell, like your back or pain or your leg or your brain. Nobody said, "Hey, say, hey, John, I'll give you $10 million. Let me take a bat and whack you in the side of the head, and you have, you'll get a concussion, and you'll have a brain injury, and it'll affect your personality. I mean, only people that really know you will know that it. And you may suffer a few years of depression, but we're gonna give you $10 million. Pretty sure, unless you were, a drug addict and wanted the money to get drugs, that you would never sell your health for right. $10 million. Yeah. I said, how about $20 million? How about $30 million?
I just wouldn't want to go through the pain for that much.
Of course. Yeah. And it's, some things are priceless. And if we don't have to make the exchange, we won't. But that's what we ask juries to do, is to place a value on pain, a value on the loss of the enjoyment of life. To imagine what that must be like, to empathize with the plaintiff. Whether somebody's leg is worth $2 million or $20 million is totally depends on the lawyer.
Is there a perception of the general public out there that trial lawyers, especially, personal injury trial lawyers with all the TV ads and the billboards everywhere, that they're just ambulance chasers and they're just out to get the money and they don't really care about the client?
Well, I think that perception is in some ways out there. I don't, do attitude and opinion surveys of the general public, but that there's some really great lawyers who do lawyer advertising, like, for example, a great law firm like Morgan & Morgan, they do a lot of lawyer advertising. Mm-hmm. But they have damn good lawyers over there. I mean, and they invest a lot in training their lawyers. But there are some lawyers that, law firms like in California.
I'm just going to throw out a name, Gloria Allred.
I think she does a great job branding herself. She's very active in women's issues. Mm-hmm. And, really is.
But does she ever try a case?
I haven't heard of her trying a case. That doesn't mean she hasn't tried cases. I'm sure she's tried cases in her career, but I'm not aware of it. I know she's a great promoter, a great businesswoman.
Yeah.
Has a very thriving, vibrant firm.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I see my perception is she's great with the media. She's great with sensationalizing, her client's problem, issue, victimization, whatever it is. And has the big press conference. She gets all the news media and everything, and probably just forces the people to finally settle where she never even has to go to trial.
Well, there is something to be said for trial by media and using the media to affect. I mean, very.
Can that be a strategy?
Of course. I mean, very astute trial lawyers, especially on the bigger cases. Of course, they're manipulating the media to, hopefully to their client's benefit. I mean, that's a whole other skill, because you're priming or preloading your potential jurors for the story of your case. Most high-end trial lawyers are very good at managing the media. That's a whole separate skill.
Can you share a case or two that you've worked on or been associated with that just kind of like mind-blowing that you had a positive outcome?
you know, I just worked on a run recently, like about a month ago, and an attorney by the name of Dave Christensen from Southfield, Michigan, came out and did my boot camp out here in Vegas. And then he had this really challenging wrongful death case because his client was schizophrenic and living on his own in some type of trap house. And it was like 5 a.m. He got into an argument with some woman who was, I think, probably on drugs, probably a crackhead. And she slashed him with a blade and cut his arm, but it cut the artery in his arm. And he went into the convenience store and asked for help and lay down on the floor and was bleeding profusely. And the clerk basically kicked him out of the store and told him to get the hell out of there. And the guy went and laid down in front of the door and bled out in about 8 minutes and died right there on the spot. And the clerk was out there taking pictures of him.
Oh.
And so it was a wrongful death claim against the store, you know, and they offered nothing because they said, you know, well, he would have died anyways, because of course they hired an expert, a pathologist, to say he would have died anyways. And of course they can hire an expert to say anything, which, you know, it's like they used to hire experts to say that cigarettes didn't cause cancer, but we know that's a bunch of horse shit. And so, you know, the ultimate result of that, you know, and he was estranged from his parents, and so that makes it more challenging when the people who, you know, would get the money, the heirs, had not really a real relationship with the deceased.
Yeah. It looks like a money grab.
They
lost their son.
Right. And, you know, they lost the possibility of a future, you know, that he would get Medicaid, because he was a very successful young man and he was going to University of Michigan and, you know, he had like a scholarship. And next thing you know, he got mental illness and overcome by schizophrenia. And, you know, can you imagine what it would be like to be a parent and have that happen? That would be so tragic. But he ended up getting a $9.5 million verdict.
Wow.
And, you know, which is a tremendous job. I mean, just, I couldn't have been happier for, you know, for the family and for him,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, he worked really hard on it.
When do you follow the news? Like, do you follow major cases that are on television? Like, you know, Jeffrey Epstein and things like that, and the lawyers associated with those type of cases?
I follow them to a bit. Like, I followed the Johnny Depp thing.
Yeah.
Probably more than, and I followed that one a bit. And then also that lawyer who was Murdaugh.
Yes, the Murdaugh murders in South Carolina. Yeah.
So I followed those two cases just because that's interesting. Because Murdaugh, because he's a lawyer, and for a lawyer to lose his mind like that and murder his own son and wife,
bone chilling. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know,
where does the mind go off the rails with something like that? I guess when you're deep into criminal activity and you're trying to cover your tracks, you'll do anything.
But to kill your own son? Now, that is just the most disturbed, bone chilling, you know, inhuman thing I've ever heard of. I watched some trials on TV, like the Johnny Depp trial and Camille Vasquez, and, you know, people are just raving about what an amazing job she did. And, you know, I wasn't that impressed with her skill set.
Hmm, interesting. What was she lacking?
She had a super aggressive attitude, which I don't think plays well in general, like that contemptuous tone. And just like, you know, the form of every question is like, right, correct, isn't it true? And I think that's bad form too, because, you know, it violates the principle of recency. And so all these people keep hearing is right, correct, isn't it true? Instead of, you know, the facts that came before it. For example, you're wearing a pink shirt. It would be more appropriate, as opposed to you're wearing a pink shirt, right? And then just right. And then you hear it over and over. It's annoying.
Yes.
And so, but you know what? Like I always say, you know, she's the one that got herself famous and won the trial. And, you know, I'm in the peanut gallery commenting. And so, you know.
Do you have a desire, when you see these big payouts and these big cases, do you have a desire to get back in and kind of raise to that level? Use your own. What you know, what you teach, your skill set, and get back in the game and try and finish it out? Yeah,
I do. You know, the only thing ever stopping me is the fact that when I do these conferences, like we have them coming up in New York City in September 20th to 23rd, when I do these conferences, they are all consuming. Like,
how many people are you inviting?
Probably in the neighborhood of, you know, 500.
Wow.
That's the goal.
That's a big conference.
It's pretty, it's like a
mid-size. And you're the showrunner for that conference.
That's true. I am the MC of the conference. So it's a pretty, it's not really big. You know, when I did a conference last year in Vegas, and there was like 1,200 people.
What advice can you give to people who are listening to this podcast on what to do if they should be caught up in a lawsuit, personal injury lawsuit, being arrested, and they're going to face criminal charges. What should they do? How do they go about picking the best lawyer?
That's a great question, because it's very difficult to do that if you don't have knowledge of the people in the industry. And, you know, if it's a personal injury case, you should see how frequently they go to trial. Not that anybody wants their case to go to trial, because that involves a lot of time, stress, and work. But if a lawyer is often going to trial, then generally they'll get more money from the insurance companies. As far as a criminal case goes, that's a whole other ball of wax. You know, some public defenders are great. Some are terrible. If you know, most people that have the means will retain their own lawyer. And that's also a crapshoot, because there's a lot of lawyers who sound good and look good, but they're very incompetent and ineffective in the courtroom. But there's a lot that look like they don't have a pot to piss in, and they're just rock stars in the courtroom. So that's a tough call.
So what is your ultimate goal? What do you want to do?
The big picture is to build a program to train all the public defenders in the country. That's my big vision.
And why do they need training?
Well, we all need training. But I believe I'm in the best position to help them and to train them to be much more effective trial lawyers, because I practiced criminal defense for 20 years. I tried probably around 175 jury trials. And I developed, a system for efficient preparation for a trial. But beyond that, a methodology for persuasion and connection in the courtroom. And public defenders in the courtroom a lot, and they have a lot of cases. And so they need to be efficient without sacrificing the quality of representation, because there's too many innocent people in prison. And the better the lawyers we have, the better trial lawyers, the better public defenders we have, the less blood needs to be shed unnecessarily and unjustly.
Amen to that. So how did you come up with this plan?
Well, about 5 years ago, I was in Costa Rica at a place called Rythmia. And the reason people go to Rythmia is to do, drink, whatever you want to call it, ayahuasca.
I've only heard horror stories about ayahuasca.
Well, like most things that are greatly beneficial to you, there is a little bit of a price to be paid to get to the benefit. And people that aren't familiar with ayahuasca, it is plant medicine, a somewhat ancient plant medicine for healing. And what it causes your body to do is to purge all the toxins. And purge takes place but it's a physical purge, not just a psychological and emotional purge.
Yeah.
And so there's a good deal of vomiting, sweating, crying, and diarrhea.
Yeah.
Like every orifice for your body is exploding. and it's not pleasant, but it is worth the journey. And so I was there for a week, and one of the initial questions they ask you is, why are you here? And I was there because a friend of mine recommended it. He said, basically, Dan, I think this will be good for you. I'm like, well, tell me more about it. I'm like,
oh my God,
just trust me. You'll. And so I did a little bit of research on it, but not a lot. Like so many people had like been planning for years to come to this, to have this experience. I'm like, well, if I get something, I get something. And the person who was leading the group was like, come on, there must be a bigger reason. Really, what's the why? And that's what I thought about it. I'm like, let's see. I don't have a wife. I don't have any kids. And, so really, what's the purpose? Why am I here? And as I thought about that question more and more, I realized that my purpose, why I'm here. So that's why I said, I want to find out why I'm here. And so then after multiple ceremonies of ayahuasca, I realized I'm here to build this program, because nobody's more ideally suited to build it. I have the skills. I have a training program. I have a lot of experience in criminal defense. I have the time, and I have the desire. And
wow.
So therefore, I have a responsibility and a duty to make it happen.
That's, I'm pretty impressed. It's pretty amazing.
No, it'll be amazing when it's built. Right now, it's only a vision. But until you make your visions reality, it's just a dream, and dreams don't change the world.
But it is starting to happen, right?
It is. In my last program, there's two public defenders that were in my boot camp training, and one of the public defenders is going to be in charge of training other public defenders in Los Angeles. And so that's kind of exciting.
Well, that's it's a big city.
Well, to make him a better coach, and so he can make the however many, whether it's 5 or 50 lawyers that he's responsible for coaching and training to make them better, to make them, you know, to win. Because winning is where it's at. Losing is not where it's at.
Well, it just keeps our prisons filled and destroys lives and everything else.
Right. And I mean, let's be honest. There are some people that need to be separated, need to be locked up.
Yeah.
But it's the ones that are innocent, the ones that are dramatically overcharged. They need the great representation. And that's what the goal is, to help provide them, not just, you know, just not just in Las Vegas, but, you know, or Los Angeles, but throughout the country. It's just going to take a little time, a little work. And I have to obviously recruit a small army of people to help me.
It all sounds great, but I got to be honest with you. I'm still stuck on multiple rounds of ayahuasca. You did?
Yes. You know, when you go to these places, you do it four nights in a row.
Oh, God.
Well, you don't know. You're only speculating what you think it would be like.
You
know,
I am.
But, you know, it's an experience. And
I don't know. Oh, man. Stronger man than me. I don't know if I could ever do that.
You could handle it, John.
No, I don't know.
You'll one day, you'll get the urge. You're like, you know what? I need to go open my mind. And next thing you know, you'll be into psychedelics. Actually, a friend of mine is in the legal business. She's not a lawyer, but she's in the industry. She just was at a psychedelics workshop last week in Denver, Colorado. And we're going to put together a retreat program in probably mostly Central America, Costa Rica, for, you know, psychedelics, you know, the using psychedelics, various psychedelics with trial lawyers. Got to keep expanding the mind and healing the soul.
You're going to become the next Timothy Leary.
You never know. We never know what our journeys hold. We just got to keep walking and guiding and being guided by our spiritual warriors.
All right, Dan. Well, wow, what a story. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, and good luck to you on the Trial Lawyers University and ayahuasca forever.
That's right. Thank you.
All right. Well, that wraps another episode of Across the Dynaverse. Many thanks to Dan Ambrose from Trial Lawyers University for spending time with me and giving me the lowdown on the law, right? If you're in the legal profession, especially if you are or know someone who is a public defender, please visit triallawyersuniversity.com to learn more about Dan and his program. It's all one word, triallawyersuniversity.com. If you like the episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And to support the show for the low, low price of $3, visit my Patreon page at patreon.com/Dynaverse. Theme music by Keith Brock and the Kings Who Rock. Across the Dynaverse, searching for the heart and soul of America, one diner at a time. I'm John Murphy. What's your story?